We've been talking about dukkha, or suffering as it's often translated in from Pali to English. And as I've said over the last few weeks, it's not an accurate or all-encompassing translation, because it includes the suffering that we get from grasping pushing away the unpleasant, and how that doesn't work because what we resist persists. We also get a sense of unsatisfactoriness from trying to grasp at the pleasant, try to keep the pleasant. Because it's impermanent, we inevitably find it unsatisfactory. So we've been talking about this and how to understand that dukkha is part of the human experience. It's part of being human. As the Buddha said, old age is dukkha, sickness, death, lamentation and grief, not getting what you want, getting too much of what you don't want, and the what he called the five aggregates of clinging are also dukkha, which is the way that we kind of construct an ego and then identify with it. It's the five aggregates is a whole other area we could talk about. So he kind of identified where this dukkha comes from, and then he of course talks about his whole teaching is what to do now, right? What's the cause of it, and how to what's the path to the cessation of dukkha, of this suffering. And of course, a lot of the suffering that we experience is constructed in our minds, because we layer upon it a story of the story of me, starring me, produced by me, and written by me, and that layering of the story is where another aspect of dukkha appears. And in fact, from my teaching, I see that this is really huge, it seems, in our society, because there's a lot of self-criticism that seems to come to the surface, a lot of almost self-hate a lot of judgments. And so there's this story that gets layered on that causes us even more suffering. Something that could just have happened and just passed becomes a big deal because of what the mind proliferates around it. So it's something to really watch in our practice. So I've really been, excuse me, I've got a bit of a cold. I talked last week about this beautiful baby that we had come visit us. How beautiful it was. The baby also gave me a cold. there's probably a whole teaching in there somewhere, because I did, before I got the cold actually, it took a while to manifest. I talked about what a beautiful manifestation and beautiful time this was. So what do we do with this dukkha? We understand it intellectually. You listen to a talk like this and you think, okay, I get it. Yeah, part of being human is there's this suffering. I get, especially, if we try to always push away the unpleasant and just kind of not let it flow through and just let it be, accept that this is our experience in the moment. I kind of get that if I grasp at the pleasant, it's unsatisfactory. People sometimes have a little bit of trouble with that one, because it's subtle. It happens at a much subtler level. But people can see that with a little bit of understanding. People see, oh yeah, my stories definitely caused me to suffer more. So you understand it at an intellectual level. We can start to understand it through our practice. So when we sit And when we walk, we watch, well, I don't know, did anybody have lots of thoughts arise while they were sitting or walking? Sometimes it's just a parade of thoughts. And that can in itself cause suffering because I'm supposed to be meditating. And here I have all these thoughts. And everybody else, geez, everybody else looks really still and quiet. And I must be really bad at this. I wonder if I should even be here. I wonder if I should even be trying to do this. Maybe I just don't have the mind that's built for this like other people. I can tell you right now, we all have that same... There isn't a being on this planet that hasn't said that so many times if they, you know, in their, if they practice regular. So we begin to see suffering arise, a pain in the knee, the dukkha due to a physical pain, maybe a story about the pain in the knee, sankhara dukkha. We see these things arise. I'm going to talk tonight about beginner's mind as a place from which we can really penetrate dukkha. We can live life from this place of beginner's mind, don't know mind, as it's often called in Vipassana. Beginner's mind comes from more of a Zen. Comes from Zen. It comes from, well, it comes from Suzuki Roshi in his book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which is, I just found out, the best, the book that sold the most copies of any book on Buddhism in the West. It's been around a long time. I'm just looking up when it was actually first edition in 1970. And then he's got ninth printing, 2005. There's probably been more since then. It's a wonderful book by a wonderful teacher that started the San Francisco Zen Center and really brought Zen to the West. Really sort of, I guess, not brought it, but really came at a time when it seemed like it was ripe and was able to really spread it throughout the United States in particular. So this is what, there's a quote from Suzuki Roshi. The person who can freely acknowledge that life is full of difficulties can be free because they are acknowledging the nature of life, that it can't be any other way. So we can acknowledge that there are difficulties as part of life, is what he's pointing to, and we've talked about that. So if we can understand this, if we can verify this in our practice, then it can be the new place from which you live. So it's not just a matter of understanding it intellectually or even getting the felt sense of it in our practice. It's a place from which you live. It becomes the way it's integrated into your life. You can live from that place. And this is just the first noble truth of the Four Noble Truths. If you only get the first noble truth, it's amazing. That'll just blow your mind right away. Just the first noble truth. That's why people move on to the second, the third, and the fourth, because the first one just kind of like, whoa! Just getting this first one is huge. And once you know this. The experience of dukkha, once you know, as Suzuki Roshi says, that you acknowledge and you just know life is full of difficulties. That's what the way it is. You can really be free. It allows you to be less caught up as well in what's going on, and allows you to respond to what's going on rather than react from a habitual place. And this is so huge. Just being able to kind of, from a place of balance, a place of stability, to be able to see what's happening in that moment and be able to, from that, you know, you can just imagine from that place of calm what kind of options open up for you, rather than one, reacting from a place of habit, and two, reacting from a place of knowing. You're kind of open. There's another quote in here that's wonderful. The most quoted quote from this book is right at the beginning, after all the forewords. There it is. In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, but in the expert's, there are few. In the beginner's mind, there are many possibilities, but in the expert's, there are few. That's what he starts the prologue with. And he's not saying there that we shouldn't know anything. Don't know mind doesn't mean know nothing mind. It's a place of openness, of freshness, to the experience of what you're experiencing. Actually, before I go into that, I want to say a bit more about integration of the First Noble Truth. Because we often, and I've said this before here, we can understand these teachings. If you listen to a lot of Dharma talks, perhaps, you know, if you go on a long trip, maybe you, instead of listening to the radio, you listen to, you know, 5 Dharma talks. Or maybe you have you read a lot of Dharma books, so you can have a lot of cognitive, conceptual understanding of the teachings. And you can wonder why, and you can sit with pain in your sittings. You can start to say, "Oh, my foot's asleep," and the sensations, they come and go, and you could, you know, get to that level. And then you can say to yourself, "But nothing's really happening. Nothing's. I'm the same old me." You may not be saying that, but that can be something that can happen with folks. And what's happening is you're not integrating the First Noble Truth. You forgot this third aspect of integrating it into your life. You've got the intellectual and the felt sense of it, but it's not becoming part of the way that you live your life. So you have to be present with your life in order to remember to apply this knowledge that you've of the truth that you've seen. And without this integration, the insights can actually be lost. So you may find yourself having the same insights over and over again. And that may occur to you at some point, "Well, I've had this insight before, what's going on?" It's that at that point of that insight is when you say, "Oh, reflect on what are the implications of this in my life? How can I integrate this into my life?" So I have here, you know, the inability to integrate hard-won insights can really limit psychological and spiritual development. We just end up re-experiencing the same insights because we haven't applied it in our lives. So I just wanted to emphasize that before I go into a beginner's mind. Because beginner's mind is really how we're integrating this truth into our lives. Coming to each moment with that open, fresh mind, as opposed to the knowing, you know, "I know what's going to happen now." The mind that is full of preconceived ideas and assumptions about what's going to happen next, rather than allowing the moments to come and be, and then respond and see what unfolds as well. realizing that shit happens too. I mean, the difficulties happen. I'm going to read this long. I just love this little story. That I'm talking a lot about Suzuki Roshi. One, because he coined the phrase beginner's mind, and he is one of my favorite teachers. If you ever get to see, there's videos on his life. He's one of the truly great teachers that's come to the West. In the sutras, it is said that there are four kinds of horse. I'm going to use the English that he used when he gave the talk. An excellent one, and a not so good one, and a bad one. The best horse will run before it sees the shadow of the whip. That is the best one. And the second one will run just before the whip reaches his skin. And that is the second one. The third one will run when it feels pain on its body. That is the third. The fourth one will run after the pain penetrates into his marrow of the bone. That is the worst one. When we hear this story, perhaps everybody wants to be a good horse, the best horse, even if it is impossible to be the best one, to be the second best. That is quite the usual understanding. But actually, when we sit, you will understand whether we are the best horse or the not so good ones. Here we have some problem in understanding of Zen. Zen is not the practice to be the best horse. If you think so, if you understand Zen is kind of a practice to be the best horse, if you have this kind of idea, you will have a problem, big problem. That is not the right understanding of Zen. Actually, if you practice right Zen, whether you are best horse or worst horse, doesn't matter. This is not the point. If you feel the mercy of Buddha, what would he do? If you think of the mercy of the Buddha, what do you think the Buddha would feel for the worst horse? He will be most sympathetic with the worst one rather than the best one. So if you have the right understanding of Zen or deeper understanding, worst horse should be the most valuable horse. And because of the imperfect character of ourselves, we have to express our innermost feeling through our imperfect body and our characters. Usually those who can sit physically perfect take more time to obtain the marrow of Zen, the true taste of Zen, the actual feeling of Zen. Those who have great difficulty in practicing Zen will find more meaning of Zen. So sometimes I think it's the best horse is the worst horse, and the worst horse is the best horse. Sometimes. It's just so, you know, we want to be the best. You know, like the best at sitting and the best. And his point is that's not the point. And in fact, those of us who maybe have the most difficulties will find the true meaning of Zen or truth or ultimate truth or whatever it might be, whatever you call it, the divine, will find that, will have an easier time finding that than the person who can easily sit perfectly and not have problems coming up in their zazen sittings. So this for me really points to beginner's mind as well. And the whole Zen koan process, I don't know if you've ever, has anybody ever gone to a Zen retreat or done a koan with a Zen master? It's quite an experience. And when I went, this is many years ago, at a Thich Nhat Hanh monastery, and they gave me a koan, and I had really no idea what I was getting into. People don't usually tell you this either. You don't try and answer a Zen koan. You ever end up at a, but if you do that, the Zen master will also kind of get you. So there's really no. Yeah. Anyway, I won't steal the the punchline. But yeah, I get the call, and I kept going in, and I can't remember what it was exactly. I think I was on a pole or something, and I had to get off this pole, and I said stupid things like, well, do I have my cell phone? And the interview's over at that point. Because I, you know, call for help. But the point is there's no solution. It was the sound of one hand clapping. That's the one we perhaps heard the most. I mean, there's no solution to these. And the idea is to get you to stop trying to solve it, right? And just let the mind kind of crack open and just be still with the not knowing. Be comfortable with the not knowing or the beginner's mind. And that's the whole point of Zen, is to kind of clear the decks of all the stuff we think we know and just be. That's what they emphasize, Zazen, just sitting and just sitting and just sitting. And so the Vipassana as well emphasized that, you know, these long retreats of just sitting in stillness and letting the Buddha mind or the original mind kind of illuminate through all the clutter that we usually have with the things that we think we know. So, beginner's mind, it comes from a Japanese word, shoshin. So that's where he brought it in through that languaging. And as I say, in Theravadan tradition or Vipassana, we tend to call it don't know mind. Again, not meaning know nothing mind, but just this open mind. So Suzuki says on page 21 of this book, the goal of practice is always to keep our beginner's mind. Always to keep the beginner's mind. And he goes on to talk about how when we, as we become more experienced practitioners, we can think we even know what's supposed to happen in the practice, and we lose our beginner's mind after we've practiced the same thing, you know, many times. So it's a mind empty of any preconceived notions about what's supposed to happen and any expectations as to what can be achieved. So it's really practice in action. Really watch to see what the mind is doing. So all of life is practice. And the practice is bringing this beginner's mind to our moment-to-moment experience all the time. There's a great story. Suzuki Roshi he's, as I said, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center. One day he was answering the phones in the office. And I could just imagine him doing it. And somebody called and said, "What time does meditation begin?" And he replied, "It never stops," and he hung up the phone. Just never stops. It's your whole life's a meditation, and with a beginner's mind that is present and just seeing things as they are. Things as they are. Treat every moment as your last. It is not preparation for something else. And you can kind of see this in children, the wonder and amazement that they have with things. So, you know, we had this child, as I said, you know, at our place 2 weekends ago, and you know, they have the stuff they have for kids now. It's amazing, like the contraptions and gadgets. I need the manual just to figure out how to feed the poor child, because I don't know how to work the seat that attaches to the counter. Have you ever seen? It's like a lever-controlled thing, and it just sticks off the end of the thing. It looks like he's just going to fall onto the floor, right? But so anyway, I get him into this contraption on the counter and to feed, to eat. So, you know, you sort of just shovel food in their mouth when they're 1 year old, as they're looking around, right? When he kind of passes, and there was an empty vitamin container. Well, this is amazing. He'd never seen such a thing. And he was just like fascinated with it. And just this curiosity and amazement. Like for him it wasn't, oh yeah, vitamin container. Mm-hmm. Boring. You know, I've seen that. You know, what it is. You know, it was, is there anything in it? What's it smell like? What's the bottom? You know, it's just this total openness and freshness to the moment. I thought, that's a beginner's mind. He's really coming at this with a fresh, open mind. Not to say that, you know, we can romanticize children now, but not to say that they're all enlightened or anything, but they do illustrate this openness or this freshness to experience, not approaching it with any prior judgment or asking, you know, at that age even, what is it? And then I put two almonds in it too, so then it made noise. Well, it was a whole toy then, right? It was like, whoa, it makes sense. So the mind's not already made up. It's investigating, it's open, it's curious. I just heard a definition of mindfulness, and it was, I forget who said it. I was listening to a bunch of Dharma talks. So one of the Dharma talks was, instead of listening to the radio, I was listening to one after the other. It had the word curiosity in the definition of mindfulness. And it's not a word, you know, I hear non-judging. But the word curiosity, it's so key. Because it's that curiosity, that openness, that beginner's mind that we bring. Seeking, but not with expectation or grasping. And just being there with it, seeing what occurs. Being ready for whatever arises in the moment. Always ready for anything. So it's difficult to do this. Right? It's easy for me to sit here and talk about it, but I know it's difficult for me. As soon as I see something, the perceptions, the habits of mind, they kick in. If I, you know, I hear a particular sound like that, the mind goes rain. Doesn't go, oh, I wonder what that, you know, it's constantly, this is what minds do, right? They label and they categorize everything to help us survive. And so, I mean, so that function is useful in our daily lives. But it can also undermine our freedom if we're never open to the, if we lose this innocence to what just occurs. And there's always a push to know, to be the expert. And if we decide we do know something, we're not open to other possibilities anymore. And that's a shame. If we have a preconceived idea of what is supposed to happen, we're disappointed when something else inevitably happens. Instead of being amazed about the possibilities, we're dissatisfied because our expectations weren't met. So we can live our lives with this sense of expectations, and this is going to happen, then this is going to happen. My partner, my wife, she retired a year ago. So I have all these expectations, right? We're going to do this. We did some traveling, and then we're going to do this and that and the other thing. And now she's back at work again. That, no, I mean, I didn't expect that. My mind didn't expect that to happen. This mind had a whole other set of preconceived notions about what was going to happen, but you know, that's what arose for her to do, and that's what she felt drawn to do. So being open to that, that possibility, without it being a problem. Another story, I think it's a Zen story. I don't know, I've just heard it so many times, I'm not sure where it comes from. I don't have an author. It's called Good Luck, Bad Luck, Who Knows? Some of you might have heard this one. There once was a simple farmer who lived and struggled alongside his neighbors and friends, trying to exist and fulfill a peaceful life. One day, news arrived from far away that his old, loving father had died. His neighbors gathered to grieve, but the farmer simply said, "Bad luck, good luck, who knows?" In time, relatives brought a very fine horse of great cost and fine breeding left to the farmer by his father. All the villagers and neighbors gathered in delight with him to celebrate his good fortune, but he said, "Good luck, bad luck, who knows?" One day the horse escaped into the hills, and when all the farmer's neighbors sympathized with the old man over his bad luck, the farmer replied, "Good luck, bad luck, who knows?" A week later, the horse returned with a herd of wild horses from the hills, and this time the neighbors congratulated the farmer on his good luck. His reply was, "Good luck, bad luck, who knows?" Then, when the farmer's son was attempting to tame one of the wild horses, he fell off its back and broke his leg. Everyone thought this was very bad luck. The farmer replied, "Good luck, bad luck, who knows?" Some weeks later, the army marched into the village and conscripted every able-bodied youth they found there. When they saw the farmer's son and his broken leg, they let him off. Now, was that good luck, bad luck? Or who knows? So we never know what's going to. The whole, you know, the silver lining kind of thing, you know. And when you hear, when I first heard that, that's what kind of, there can be a silver lining in what we think is bad luck, or, you know, we really don't know ultimately what sequence of events will unfold based on all the possible causes and conditions that can come together. Lest we take the not knowing practice too far, Suzuki Roshi said. Not knowing does not mean you don't know, as I said at the very beginning. So it doesn't require us to forget everything we know, to suspend all interpretations of situations. Not knowing means not being limited by what we know, holding what we know lightly so that we are ready for it to be different. Maybe things are this way, maybe they are not. So of course we have opinions and views. It doesn't mean we don't never state an opinion about anything. We have those opinions and views, but it's being able to hold them lightly. Maybe that's an opinion that this mind can project out there, but you really don't know. I'll have opinions about Rob Ford. They'll emerge. I have a friend who goes into a fit if anybody defends him, but. But you know, it's an opinion that this mind is formed based on a lifetime of causes and conditions. Somebody else may have a different opinion, and it's holding lightly, so that you can be ready for something to be different, and that can be tough in politics. So it leads to intimacy and an open mind, and intimacy with the moment. Maybe a humility in the moment. Another word might be a surrender. Not resignation, but a surrender to the moment. Because we don't really know. So it's not knowing, it's that beginner's, that freshness with what's happening. Because we really don't know what might happen next. And with this, you cut through all the ways that the mind clings. Because ultimately, that's what's causing suffering, is the mind that clings. The whole teaching of the Buddha, all the lists he came out with, all the five this and the six that and the seven that, all ultimately say in one way or another, clinging causes suffering. And there is a way for this to cease. So that's the good news. The bad news is this happens. It's bad news. It's human existence. But the other side is that there's a way that this ceases. So this beginner's mind is a way that we can cut through the mind that clings. That makes sense. Does that make sense to folks? How a beginner's mind can cut through? Because with the beginner's mind, there's no clinging. Because you're open. The mind's not, there's not that contracting. The mind's not contracting around. The pleasant or, repulsing the unpleasant. This is arising in this moment. The mind is labeling, it's labeled, my mind is labeling it unpleasant. What else is here? What can I open to in this moment? I'm talking everything too. I know people go, oh yeah, but this is everything that he's talking about. You practice this way until the mind lets go of itself and finally knows ultimate freedom. Then beginner's mind has served its purpose. You let that go. Like all the Buddha's teachings, right? It's like the raft. The metaphor of the raft. All his teachings are a raft that you take across the river. Gets you across the river to the other shore and you see something new. But you're at the other shore, you ditch the raft, you don't carry the raft around with you. This is a great teaching. See my raft. And then get another raft. And before you know it, you can't carry all the... You ditch that to you. So the beginner's mind is one of those teachings. It gets you to the other shore. It served its ultimate purpose because eventually the mind lets go of itself. Stop clinging to the mind, believing that every thought you have is important or true. I use this phrase and people sometimes look. A thought is a secretion of the mind. It's what minds do is they secrete these thoughts. And they're useful thoughts. They help us operate iPhones But if we believe them all as fact, and that they're us, and we identify with them, this is suffering. This is part of the four aggregates of clinging. So in sitting meditation or walking meditation, we notice the busyness of our minds. Perhaps we notice the fixed views that arise about this or that, fixed views that we carry around with us. And once we notice these fixed views, we notice these preconceptions, then it's possible for us to let them go and say, well, maybe not, maybe so. You see the view, maybe it is, maybe it isn't. You may also notice the busyness of the mind. If you stop believing everything the mind secretes, it often starts to secrete less. But the more you sort of believe it and feed it, it tends to get juice and momentum, so to speak. That's what I find in my practice. Went through a period not that long ago, this past summer, when all my sittings, the mind was just like going and going and going. And so the thought arose, I wonder why this is happening. And so I got all, you know, should be able to figure this out. I'm a guiding teacher of Sangha, and I teach MBSR and retreats and all. Should be able to figure this out. And of course, that I didn't. I didn't fix it. And then it occurred to me that the word I hear, and the word that has helped me in my practice often, is surrender. And then when the mind surrendered, it let go of itself. It kind of lost its momentum, and it was a kind of a slow unwinding, unwinding process. So there was part of why the mind got busy too is there's so much busyness in my life. We had a lot of visitors at the cottage, so there's like all these people all around. And, you know, even my meditations, I'd be in a room, there'd be like coffee machines going and people putting music on and then going, shh, Steve's meditating, and then, you know, so on and so forth. So so there's one's environment and also has a view, so also has a impact. So there's also those things to look after. I've said that already, that the essence of practice is not always so. So that's a phrase, a Zen phrase you can bring to mind when the mind solidifies on something. Not always so. That phrase I just used, when the mind solidifies on something, is from a story that Matt told, and he said something to Bhante Ji, his teacher, and Bhante Ji said, this was some kind of fixed view that he had, and Bhante Ji goes, that's very interesting, I hope your mind doesn't solidify around that. It's an interesting view, but, you know, as long as you don't get too, you know. And Matt thought he'd like, you know, it was just like, whew, it was big, right? I forget what it was. I'll have to ask him what this, it was big. And he thought, oh, it's very good, very good. Just mind, watch the mind to see if it solidifies around that. So looking at what other possibilities there might be in that moment, and not always so. So I'll end there and just open it up to any any questions about that talk or about anything else. Oh yeah, we have this. What do we call it? Like a
convention.
That's better. Protocol seems to convention where we. Before we speak, we go like this, and then everybody recognizes. And then when you're finished, you go like this, and everybody recognizes. So we just recognize Richard.
You mentioned surrender, and I've heard that term before by Buddhists, but also like the more common connotation is losing something or giving up. You know, so I don't know. So when you use it, like, what are you thinking? Like, you mentioned letting go or accepting.
Yeah, surrender's one of those words. It's different than renunciation, which is more of the giving. It has a connotation of, you know, giving things up, like, you know, renounce, you give up alcohol and other intoxicants and, you know, these other kinds of simplify life. So it's different than that. And it's a word you often hear in Christianity more than you hear in Buddhism or Taoism or other Eastern traditions. In the context that I'm using it, it's a surrendering to what is in the moment, the possibilities of that moment. So it's a, you know, when you let go of expectations, you let go of preconceived notions of what might occur, and you can surrender to just what is. That's probably the most concise answer I've ever given. Hopefully it answers your question as well. Maybe I'll say more about the surrender. we see it in our practice as well. And I've said before, you know, our sitting meditation and our walking meditation and our yoga or whatever we might do, Tai Chi, is just like a dress rehearsal or just a rehearsal for life. So, you know, when we see how surrender arises in our sitting practice, that knowing can transfer to our life. So what I sometimes notice is, well, something as physical as simple as a physical pain, when physical pain arises, and I'm talking about like, so say like an injury or a severe headache or you get migraines or something like that. while we're in our sitting meditation. So what can arise? You know, all kinds of things can arise from that. But what I've seen arise in students I've worked with and in myself is the mind wants to fix it, right? So the fix-it mind jumps in, not the beginner's mind, but the mind that knows this is what I should do to, or the I should have mind, the blaming mind might come. I should have. I've got this because I didn't X, Y, or Z, right? So one of those, the fix-it or the blaming mind, we'll jump in, and of course, what you notice in your practice is that the example of a headache that doesn't help it go away. It, in fact, often or can exacerbate it because you know, you're layering on. There's a bit of layering on of a story as well. So surrender, and I'll nuance that. So you've heard a Dharma talk here, and you've read somewhere, and it said you got to let go, right? Not try to fix it, but let go, let it be. So you go, okay, I'm going to let it go. Now it's going to go away. So it's fix it with a, it's kind of like trying to trick it through the Buddhist twist, right? And of course it doesn't work either. And you notice that, you go, okay, so then you go, well, what the heck? Okay, I've tried the regular habitual, let's fix it or blame it, and that didn't work. And I even tried the Buddhist fix it that Steve always talks about, and that didn't work. So now you're at a loss. You know, what do I do? What do I do? What next? And you might come up with another strategy that I haven't talked about and tried that, and that doesn't work either. So you run out of strategies at some point, and all that's left to do is surrender. Now, this is here in this moment. With beginner's mind, I don't know, you don't know where it came from. You can't know where it's going. Sometimes with severe pain, it can be actually be a, like a, what's the word? It's a solid or a, you know, a voice that actually says, I give up. I don't know what to, and the mind just kind of allows around it. That's probably the purest example of surrender in practice. Especially with intense physical pain. And once that allowing happens, then you start to see, oh, there's some softness that can around this as well. So that's an example in practice. And of course, you see it in life too, when we really struggle with something. The example I used to give, and it just came to mind now, is the inventors who work, the story goes, Newton, and I think there's a bunch of stories about particular where they were just in the lab, and they're just trying to, and they know they're close to the solution to like the big problem, like mechanical physics or whatever it might be, and they're struggling, and it's not coming, and they go, I can't get this, almost like it's impossible, and they go for a walk down the street, let their mind clear, and boom, the solution comes. So there's a surrendering there, that an allowing that frees open some space for something else to come in. So I see that as a form of surrender as well. Maybe, and you can see that in your life. So it's really surrendering to the moment. Yeah. Because you don't know what's going to happen. And with that freedom, there's a real easefulness that can emerge with that, a real joy and a real compassion that arises, and compassion for other people that are also struggling. I mean, we're all struggling with different things. You really see this with family. We all think we have dysfunctional families because everybody's struggles. Right? You think everybody else's family looks also just so balanced and solid. You just don't know all their struggles. If you got in their family the way that you're in your family. Don't we all think our families are just, I'm not the only one, right? Okay. Just checking. I thought maybe I was the only. And people outside our family think it's a highly functional family, right? On the surface, partly because my family likes everybody to think that, right? It's one of the appearances are important, right? That'd be more like not my immediate, not my family, but my extended family. But yeah, so that's so we start. A real sense of compassion arises with that too, as we see that fills that space when we allow and when we surrender, when we let go, and the compassion that can be with other people as they're trying to figure this out. Yeah.
About this, hopefully, it's not looking for solutions necessarily, but I've just started a job as an assistant teacher in the master. And there's at least one, there are more, there's one hurricane child in there. And I'm struggling so much with mindfulness around it. You're talking about surrender and I'm reacting, not out inside, I'm imploding. But there's this insincerity, which I value, of course, and how I'm trying to speak in the child. But I'm reacting all the time, trying to redirect, trying to distract, trying to adjust the whole path currently. We are working on certain things around that. But trying to think, where does my mindfulness fit into this, because there doesn't feel like there's a moment during the day in contact time because you just go to assist. And then afterwards, if I think about it, if I can even assist or at another time, I think I just let it go. I just think about more strategies, but it's becoming a very physical. And I'm just not sure, again, when it feels like there is no time in a moment, truly be mindful. Is there time? Am I just missing that?
Well, every moment is just a moment like any other moment that we can bring awareness to. Not to diminish the challenge about what you're speaking about, but those are just moments with lots of, it sounds like kind of chaotic activity within it from a particular child, and all you can do from your experience, I mean, obviously you have your job to do, and the mind will, you'll come up with strategies that may or may not do what you think they'll do. But it's in those moments when you can just be with what's happening in those moments, kind of one moment at a time. Because often our mind will project, okay, I want this to happen, and I want this to happen. So in a way, it's a perfect beginner's mind scenario, because all you're doing is trying different things and seeing what happens. Maybe so. Maybe one day it has that effect, and depending on where the child's at. And sometimes there's safety concerns, and there's all those practical considerations that, of course, are important, right? You can't just march into work and say, "Well, I'm practicing beginner's mind now, and I don't know, so we're just going to let everything kind of fly into the, I'm going to surrender, and things are just going to fly into." So that's not a practical. Practical way to approach it, but you can practice in those moments. practice being present with the child, present with what's happening, present with what's arising in you as a result, like watching if there's anxiety, what that feels like in the body. It sounds like coming back to the body would be very helpful during that whole process. Yeah. So just coming back to the body during those moments, especially if you're seeing anxiety arise. And, you know, I've seen, it's amazing when one person in a room is just balanced, how that can spill into other parts of the room. With children in particular, but even with adults. Yeah. Just been, I don't know, seeing how that may shift how you respond rather than react. Because we can react habitually with the same, you know, and the child may tune into, oh, she's in a different place. Yeah. It's no magic, it's not a magic pill or magic anything. The example that comes to mind is not with children, it's with adults, and it was in a work environment where it was very conflictual, a lot of conflict, lots of ego posturing. So what I mean by that is people took everything personally. So, you know, and held views as if they were life and death. You know, this is and defended them with, like, you know, and if you disagreed, it was like I just came in, you know, and it's habitually that's how we were there was responding to one another. Came in with and just allowing, just being present with what was arising in me, and things would come out of my mouth that weren't escalating, they were de-escalating. And even just little subtle things. And it was just over time I started to notice a shift. As just one person in a group of many just kind of was just balanced and de-escalating. If somebody, when I remember at one point somebody came at me because they wanted me to. So at one point somebody got very personal. I thought, I'm going to chink through this armor, right? Because it's like a protective. And you get through that, and I'm going to get a rise out of them. And what came up as a response was, "That's very interesting. Can you say more about that?" And they just went, "Huh?" It's like there was nothing more they could. Like it didn't work, right? So it's just. It's just seeing what arises from that place. But again, it's. Not easy. It's because there's all kinds of, and kids will test. Says, "Oh, she's balanced. Let's see if I can throw this off." You know, yeah. Being open to what you know, where the child's at. Yeah, yeah. It's not easy. Yeah. and we're also out of time. I'm cognizant of people having to go places and. So welcome to the new folks. It's great to meet you and have you here. And hope to see you again. And good to see you all as well. Okay.